the philosophy of education. And everyone, please meet Stephen Downs, who you now know a little something about. Yeah, let's. If we're gonna wave, let's wave. Let's. All right. And so you, so Stephen, as I mentioned to you yesterday, they had a chance to look at your new article in the European Journal, as well as the presentation that you gave, I think, at the end of last week.
Mm-hmm.
And the notes that you sent me, yes, the Google Doc, and some of the students have even made some comments, which they discovered they were embarrassed about, not realizing you could see them. So, I tried to reassure them that you would be fine, but
totally fine.
Okay, great. So just to kind of set the table a little bit, I explained to Stephen, so for the students in the class, I explained to Stephen that what we've been working on so far, which is the course is organized around the fundamental question, which is what are the differences between learning and education? And then also that we've been, so there's lots of ways to address that question. We've been addressing it from a philosophical standpoint. And Stephen, you'd be interested to know, or you might be interested to know, that in the, so that asking that question and kind of having a broad discussion about it led in our first session 5 weeks ago led to an almost immediate distinction between a learning being an individual phenomenon and education being a systems phenomenon, with people actually very articulate about systems. I don't think I chuckled out loud, or if I did, people didn't notice, but I was chuckling out loud knowing that we would be talking to you relatively soon, given that that's where things evolved. And then I also let Stephen know, you know, we've read about the ancient guys and the empiricists and the rationalists and kind of where we've been. And I've asked him to speak with you generally about connectivism, but more broadly about the question that we have engaged in this course. So, Stephen, how's that for a setup? Is there anything more I should say or anything else you'd like to say to introduce yourself?
No, I think that's probably good.
Okay.
So what I've done to prepare for this, and just as an aside, I've prepared for this badly, but did what I could. No, I'm just kidding. I prepared for this extremely well. Also kidding. I looked at some of the stuff that I've written in the past on the philosophy of connectivism. Now, I did not address the question of what are the differences between learning and education directly, nor do I think will I. I mean, I could talk about that, but you know, when we get into the question of systems and networks and that, I think we need to establish some fundamentals first, and then maybe as an outcome of all of that, we can get to the differences between learning and education. But anyhow, I focus on a couple of things specifically. One thing I focused on was a paper I wrote back in 2005. The word paper is very loose. It was a long blog post, a long stream of consciousness blog post called An Introduction to Connective Knowledge. And the other one is something more recent that I wrote called simply Consciousness. And then I added a little bit of Wittgenstein to that. There's probably more that I could add to that and probably should add to that, but it gives us a good place to start. One of the things Gerald said was that you guys had looked at the ancients, you'd looked at Descartes, and relatively recently looked at David Hume. And I'll judge, is that correct?
That was close. Yes, and Hume was as recent as Monday.
Hume was as recent as Monday. Okay. So I saw one half-hearted nod, so it must be morning where you got... No, I'm just kidding. Where are you, by the way? I should know this, but I don't.
We're in New York City on the Pace University campus.
Pace. Oh, that explains the Pace on your shirts. Okay. right. All right. So I decided to begin with skepticism because that'll be kind of fresh in your thinking. And I was for many years, and still am to a degree, influenced by skepticism. I remember once asking, when I was still an undergrad, I asked a friend called, I think it was Mark Amiot, is skepticism right? Because I was a naive undergrad. And his response was, the skeptic is a dirty bastard, but yes, the skeptic is right. And I've studied, you know, the problem of induction and things like that since then to a fair degree of detail. And yes, the skeptic is right. But the question is, why is the skeptic right? Because in another important sense, the skeptic is wrong. And the skeptic is wrong in the sense, paraphrase G.E. Moore, here is a cup. And we know this, right? And the skeptic says, well, we don't know this. So what's going on? And what it is that the skeptic is saying is that there's no way I can infer from my sensations, whatever they happen to be. In other words, there's no way I can infer from my inner life to the existence of this cup in an external world. And so that bothered me for many years and has bothered philosophers for many centuries. And ultimately, for a variety of reasons, I came to the conclusion that we don't actually make such an inference. First of all, because we can't, and secondly, because we don't need to. I'm drawing here from a guy called J.J. Gibson, to a large degree, who writes about direct perception. But essentially, the response to skepticism is a response something like, we perceive objects directly, just as we perceive color or feelings or sounds or maple smoked bacon or whatever directly. That was your obligatory Canadian content there. So, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. They don't know that you're in Canada.
Oh, yeah. I'm in Canada. Sorry. How could you not tell? I mean, get the plaid going here. I mean, my goodness. I'm allowed to have long hair. No, I'm just kidding. So now, as a bit of an offshoot of that, but as a relevant offshoot from that, arises my view on consciousness. And, you know, because again, the problem of consciousness, what David Chalmers calls the hard problem, is, you know, how can we be conscious of the world, of the external world, right? How do we make sense of our senses with respect to the external world? What is consciousness exactly? And so my answer to that is, consciousness is sensation. No more, no less. If you think about it, everything you know, everything you believe, everything you feel, everything you wish for, all of that is, on the one hand, a sensation, and on the other hand, part of your consciousness. And from my perspective, there isn't anything over and above that that we would call consciousness. Gilbert Ryle used to talk about what he called category error. And he used the example of a university. I don't know what your university is like, but take a normal university. Maybe like yours, maybe not, I don't know. And you go to the university and you look around, you see buildings, you see students, you see professors, you see whiteboards, desks, you see a building with the heading athletics or whatever. You look around and say, yeah, but where's the university? Right? Consciousness is like that, right? It's not something over and above all of the things that go into what we call consciousness. It's not anything over and above all of the individual experiences that we have. So when we're talking about what's the origin of that, we can try explaining consciousness, right? We can say that, you know, I mean, it's the stimulation of neurons that cause perceptions, etc. But that's not saying that consciousness is the stimulating of, well, it is and it isn't, right? It is the stimulation of neurons, but the language that we use here, the stimulation of neurons, is an explanation. But we experience consciousness just like we experience the cup, just like we experience all of our other feelings and perceptions. We experience that directly. Okay. That's still a bit of scene setting. Now, the hard question is, how do our beliefs turn out to be about something? How is it that I have a belief about this cup? Oops, missed the camera there. About this cup when the cup is external to the mind. Because all of our beliefs, etc., are internal to the mind. Well, again, we know that there's no inference. As I've said, we experience these things directly. They are sensations of the external world. The problem of the subjective feel of consciousness, what it feels like to see the color red, say, or what it feels like to listen to Bruce Springsteen, the boss, is experienced directly. And the way to talk about that, it's like seeing something, I don't even want to say it's like seeing something from the inside and seeing from the outside, because in a real sense, there is no outside. It's like, again, if you look at a fire, right? I remember someone once asked, what is a fire? And the answer was given, well, it's the ionization of carbon atoms as they are released through the oxidization of substance like wood. And the person said, yeah, I get that, but where is the fire, right? There aren't two distinct things here. There isn't one distinct thing, which is the stimulation of neurons, and another distinct thing, which is the sensation of red. The stimulation of neurons is the sensation of red. So far, so good?
Questions so far? Okay. You seem to be okay on this side.
Okay. Is it clear so far?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good. Because that's important. It's important to be clear. Because otherwise, well, literally, it wouldn't make sense. Okay. All right. Now. Now we move into the mind itself and thought itself. And there are two perspectives. One which we'll call the Cartesian view, although it's not limited to Descartes. Probably in a way predates Descartes, although certainly he's the one who brought it to the fore. And then the correct story. So the question is, what constitutes an explanation of anything? An explanation of mind, an explanation of nature. The traditional view, the Cartesian view, and it's gone through various iterations through time, is that we explain these things with reference to universals or abstracts. For example, a law of nature, for example, a mathematical principle, if you're Plato's, for example, the ideal forms of geometry and of being and whatever. But this fails, and it fails for a couple of reasons. First of all, referring back to skepticism again, there's no principle of logic or reason that allows us to infer to the existence of or the nature of these abstract universals. So there's no way to confirm or verify or falsify any of these abstractions, these laws of natures, through experimentation or experience. Now, this will go exactly contrary to the theory of science that you have been taught. And indeed, probably the theory of knowledge that you have been taught. Think about what you think science is, right? You go out there, you do some experiments, and through time, a whole bunch of experiments, testing, falsification, whatever, you prove some abstract truth like E equals MC squared to be true, right? And how do we know E equals MC squared is true? Well, we have a pile of evidence that confirms it, and we've tried to falsify it and failed so far. The problem is that logical inference simply doesn't work. We actually, if you study science, come to believe E equals MC squared is true for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with the actual experiments. Experiments help. They add an aura of believability to the whole enterprise. But really, when you think about it, what is it about E equals MC squared or any of these scientific principles that appeals to us? Well, one is it, to draw on a phrase of, I think it's Heidegger's, zagente phenomena, to save the phenomena. It matches what we actually experience. So, bonus. Of course, a lot of things match what we actually experience. It's simple. We like that it's simple. That matters a lot to us. It's parsimonious. We can use one principle to apply to a bunch of things. That's why everybody loved Newton's laws so much. They united two previously disunited sciences, the science of gravity on Earth and the science of the motion of the planets. Didn't make his laws true, but it sure made them more appealing. So, if in fact we're not using logic and inference to come up to these things, to come up with these explanations, then how are we doing it? And this is where the story, to my mind, gets interesting. And this is where the story stops being abstract philosophy and actually starts being, real philosophy and also connectivist philosophy. Maybe I shouldn't say it like that. Sorry, all you philosophers who are doing something that is not connectivist philosophy that I just implied is not real. That's not what I meant. Okay. So here's the explanation of mind. The human brain is composed of layers of connected neurons. You know this. You can go into a brain and actually see them. We also know that the top layer, or the outermost layer, is the sensory layer. We know that, for example, on the retina, we have a bunch of neural cells. They connect through another few layers of cells into the visual cortex back here, and then on. These neurons are densely interconnected, and conscious experience is ultimately the firing of these inner layers of neurons. So that's what sensation actually is. That's what thought actually is. That's what belief actually is the firings of these neurons that are interconnected with each other. Now, what's significant here is there's no story about a language of thought. There's no story about how our brain stores information, has a buffer system, has rules or representations or anything like that. It's strictly a story about the activation of interconnected neurons. Now, it is more complex than that, but it's not more complex in a semantic or cognitivist way. It's more complex in a biochemical way. For example, the brain is organized into layers. For example, there is modularity between the different sections of the brain. So we need to take all of that into account. For example, there are many different types of neurons that do slightly different things. For example, the activation of a neuron is controlled by a chemical process, which creates an activation function, which gives us a variable we can measure, etc. So it's not just interconnected neurons fire, right? There's a lot of complexity, but this complexity is messy biological stuff, not messy logic, linguistic, and mathematical stuff. So far, so good? Do you believe me so far? That's a relevant question, isn't it? Because there's no point continuing if I haven't gotten past this point. All right. So,
hey, well, hold on. Anyone have a yeah, but, or what about, or...
That makes sense.
Go ahead. What?
I said it makes sense.
Makes sense, great.
Yeah.
I read the gist.
See, that's the role of a philosopher, is to lead you gradually and insensitively to a conclusion that you know is wrong. No, I'm just kidding. All right. So, given all of that, we're finally getting toward education. We reach the question, what is knowledge? Now, the traditional definition of knowledge, that if you haven't seen yet, then if you're students of philosophy, you will certainly see in the years ahead. The traditional definition of knowledge is something called justified true belief. And you see the elements of it, right? Justified, there needs to be some kind of inferential process. And there are different words for it, different ways of justifying. Could be inductively justified, could be through a process of reliabilism, whatever. There's a whole bunch of things. And then true, that's kind of a hard one, because what do we mean by truth? And you'll learn, if you haven't already, that there are different theories of truth. There's Tarski's definition of truth. Snow is white, if and only if snow is white. In other words, truth by reference to the external world, or it might be truth through coherence. Might be, as one of the comments suggested, truth by agreements of a community. Different definitions of truth. And then belief, knowledge has a doxastic component. In other words, knowing involves a personal I don't want to say commitment, personal relationship, personal acceptance, that's maybe too weak, you know, a willingness to endorse that something is true. Frank Ramsey might say, you would bet on it. That's the traditional definition of truth, but it's wrong. Of course it's wrong. There's a series of counterexamples called Gettier cases, which basically boil down to something could be justified, could be true, could be believed, could still be false. Or could be true, but known only by accident. There's a bunch of these cases. But even more to the point, that's not actually how we know things. Just do a thought experiment. How do you know the things that you know? Maybe look around you, pick out something right now that you know, and ask yourself, how do you know it? Ask yourself, did you go through an inferential process to know it? Almost certainly not, right? There are people with paste on their shirts. Did you do an inference to know that? No, but you know it, except for the people in the back row who can't see them. Is it true? Well, how would you tell whether or not it was true? Is it believed? Well, yeah, it's believed, but what is a belief on this picture? Is it, as the common story goes, a propositional attitude? In other words, an attitude, a degree of affirmation that you have to a proposition, a sentence, say. Are you actually, when you say, I know that Pace is on that shirt, are you actually saying, I have a justified belief through a process of inference about this true fact that the sentence, Pace is on the shirt, is true? Is that the story of your knowledge? Or did you just look at the shirt and go, yeah, I know that? Probably the second, right? Almost certainly the second. So what's going on? Here's the alternative theory. I don't want to say my theory, although I would say I'm certainly in a minority in proposing this. And backed by the neural network account. The theory is this. Knowledge is recognition. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, a couple ways of getting at that. The first way of getting at that, well, it's a train going by. I don't know if you can hear it.
Yes. I didn't know whether it means you're going to start talking faster because it's picking you up or whether it's going by.
I love trains. I'm sorry. All right. That's why I live near the train tracks, because I love trains. Okay. So, knowledge is recognition. Imagine, you have trains in the U.S., right? Imagine you're going to the train station. Oh, yeah, you're in New York City. You actually have train stations even. So, you go to the train station, and you're meeting your mother in the train station. And you're watching the people coming in off the train, and you go, ah, there's my mother. And if somebody asked you, do you know that? You say, yes, I know that. Right? So, what happened? You knew your mother because you recognized your mother. Note that you did not go through an inferential process, right? She's wearing her old red coat. Therefore, she is my mother. No, nothing like that. There was no execution of a rules-based process or anything like that. It was an immediate snap to awareness. That is my mother. It's like, where's Waldo? Are you familiar with Where's Waldo? Right?
Yes.
Look at the picture, right? And eventually, after a little while, you find Waldo, right? Presumably, you find Waldo. At that point, you know where Waldo is. how do you know? Because you recognize Waldo. But what's interesting about that is once you recognize where Waldo is, you can't unknow it. Which is why you have to buy books of Where's Waldo. It'd be great if you could just use the same picture over and over again, but that doesn't work, right? I used to say, and I still say, you know, to know something is to can't not know it, which sounds kind of like a tautology, but if you think about it, not necessarily. All right, well, how does that story cash out on the neural network story? Here's how this works. As you're exposed to experience from birth to now, and presumably in the future, unless something really catastrophic happens, you receive sensations. These sensations impact on your, the scientific explanation is, you know, they're photons or sound waves or whatever, impacting on your neural cells, and these signals propagate through your brain. Right? Same story I just told a few minutes ago. And we know that that story is true because we can measure it. There's instruments and all of that. We've completely mapped the neural networks of some small and insignificant animals who are now significant because we've completely mapped their neural networks. And we're in the process of doing the same for higher order creatures. Okay, well, big deal. Who cares? Well, the thing is that the nature of these connections between the neurons is altered or adjusted by these sensations. The human neural network and other neural networks are what they call plastic. It's sometimes called the plasticity of mind. By plastic, I don't mean that, you know, they're made out of the same material as Legos. By plastic, what I mean is the nature of the connections between neurons can change. And they can change either by forming or breaking the connections, or they can change by strengthening or weakening the connections. Again, this is part of the messy details, the messy biological details of neuroscience. So, sensations literally change your brain. They change your brain by altering the connections between neurons. So, there are some characteristic ways that this can happen. And in the field of artificial intelligence, deep learning, and subjects like that, they've explored some of these characteristics. But for our purposes, we can work with the simplest one of these, which is called Hebbian associationism, named after Donald O. Hebb, which is basically what fires together, wires together. It's a principle of associationism based on similarity. Two neurons will tend to form a connection with each other if they fire at the same time together or they don't fire at the same time together. So what that means is, over time, if we see something that's similar, like we see a cat every day, a characteristic set of connections between neurons will form. Make sense? See a cat, get a certain pattern of connectivity over time. Doesn't happen after the first cat. It takes like maybe, I don't know, 100 cats, 1,000 cats. Can be the same cat, can be different cats, doesn't really matter. But you get this pattern of connectivity in the mind. Such that the next time you see a cat, that same pattern of neurons is activated. So, or even better, the next time you see part of a cat, the pattern of neurons for the whole cat are fired. Now, if you think about it, that is kind of how the perception of a cat works, right? You can recognize a cat simply by seeing the tail of a cat, or the head of a cat, or even footprints of a cat, right? Because, you know, they'll come along with it. So knowing what a cat is, essentially it boils down to being able to recognize cats. This is something that happens naturally. It happens as a result of simple, basic properties of connectivity in the mind. Hume would say it is the result of custom and habit. It's a habitual association in the mind. But what's really interesting here is that there's no word cat in our mind, not unless we learn the English language and eventually associate the word cat, which is actually a set of symbols and sounds, with an actual cat. You know, somebody who's French wouldn't have that. They'd have the word chat. And in China, I don't even know what the word cat is in Chinese. A meow. Sorry, I couldn't resist. It would be funny if that really was the word. Anyhow. So there's...
It's Mao, M-A-O, because they, like, in China, like, they don't, like, we think that a cat says meow, but they think a cat says Mao. When it, like...
Right. See, there's a classic case of a Gettier, right? It was justified because I based it on the sound of a cat. It was true, and for a brief moment there, I believed it, but... I was right completely by accident. All right. So, think about the story that we've created now, right? This is an explanation, right? The explanation of mind is that we have a neural network. The neural network forms characteristic patterns of connectivity such that when we're presented with new phenomena, that pattern of connectivity might be activated, which is a process I call recognition. So how do we learn, then? Really boils down to how do we acquire this pattern of connectivity? And that's a really important question. And it's interesting because if you looked up learning theory on the internet, you'd find a whole bunch of references, not to the education system, but to artificial intelligence, and in particular machine learning. And they'd be talking about how the connections between individual entities in a network are formed. So there are different ways of explaining this. But the first thing to say is there's no magic way of learning things, right? There's no such thing as putting sentences into your head and voila, you learn. In fact, learning has nothing to do with putting sentences in your head. Learning has nothing to do even with putting content in your head. Nothing. Which is, as an aside, why it's so hard for lectures to work. Because if I just give you a content dump, which I'm doing here, you're not going to learn that. Which is what I expect. I don't expect you to learn all the stuff that I'm talking about. What I'm up to here is trying to stimulate you just enough that you'll see the world slightly differently in the future, and this slight difference will gradually accumulate over time. It's kind of sneaky, but It works. So, how do these connections form in the mind? Well, again, there's a huge literature on this, but for simplicity's sake, I group them into four categories. Hebbian associationism, which I've already talked about. Backpropagation, which is the idea that producing feedback from the output of an association can correct the network of connectivity that led to that output. Something called Boltzmann associationism, and that's drawn from the laws of thermodynamics, which suggests that we want to settle, that's a technical term, into the most energy conserving state. It's kind of like if you throw a rock into a pond, you create some ripples, but then gradually the pond will settle. And the Boltzmann model says that our network of connections will do the same thing. We have an experience, it shakes them up, and then they settle. You get another experience, it shakes them up, and then they settle. And then just simply contiguity. Things that are beside each other might wire together. And so, okay. Those are empirical. We can go out and test those. We can test those in actual neurons. We can test those in computer simulations of brains. And a lot of artificial intelligence is what they have actually been doing. Can we build systems that learn the way a person learns? And the answer, when I first started this, the answer was unequivocally no. We can't. Totally won't work. But now we have neural networks that can talk to you badly, but they can talk to you. That can drive your car, sometimes into other cars, but they can drive your car, which, even if they do it badly, is pretty impressive. They can clean your house, etc., right? There's a huge range of applications for artificial intelligence based on processing that. Only a few decades ago, we would have said, only humans can do that, because systems based on rules, memories, operating systems, etc., were not capable of doing that. Neural networks, though, artificial neural networks, are capable of doing that. How are we doing so far? Okay. So, maybe I'll wrap up by coming back to the distinction between learning and education. But I don't know if this is really that, but yeah, I'll do this. Okay. The proposition now is that a network can learn. And we say that a network can learn because the set of connections between the entities in the network are plastic. They can form characteristic organizations based on input, based on sensory input. This process just is, as an aside, consciousness. So our feeling of learning just is this thing that's happening. But if a network can learn, then at least in principle, and not everyone would agree with this, and we can talk about that, but at least in principle, any network can learn. And it's interesting, there's been a fair amount of work done in the area of network learning that has nothing to do with computers and nothing to do with human brains. The whole area of social network theory, done by people like Duncan J. Watts and Alfred Laszlo Barabasi. Watts, for example, discovered that a whole pile of crickets that are chirping. You know, each cricket is an independent, autonomous cricket. There's no master cricket telling them when to chirp, because crickets just are not smart enough to do that. But when they're out chirping out there in the world, they can hear each other. And what happens over time is the crickets tend to chirp in unison. So a network of crickets forms, and forms in such a way that there are characteristic cricket chirpings. That's not much learning, but it's learning. How many of you have heard of a murmuration? Zero.
Maybe one person, she's maybe non-committal.
She's non-committal, yeah, I see her, yeah. So a murmuration is a collection of birds, like a flock, where the birds fly around in a changing, evolving pattern. Right, and you see, like, you know, if you see several thousand starlings flying around in the air, it's like this gradually moving and shaping globe of starlings. That's a murmuration. Now, again, no, there's no head starling. What's happening is each starling is attending to a few starlings near it. Right, so the starling's world, it's a bird, right? Its world is very limited. I see three starlings, right? And that's it. But those, what it's doing is it reacts to the motions of the starlings nearest it. So what happens is, if one starling somewhere in the murmuration detects, for whatever reason, a reason to change direction, maybe they see a hawk, maybe they see the ground approaching, whatever. So the one starling changes direction, the three starlings nearest it change direction, and then that signal propagates through the entire murmuration of starling, and the whole thing moves as though it's a unit. Which is pretty cool. And it's pretty interesting. So, we have this phenomenon here where patterns of connectivity can exist really in any sort of network. And so learning, either to a low degree, like the learning done by a mealworm, is pretty minimal, but it still learns. You can still train mealworms, not to do calculus, but you can still train them, to the learning done by a human, which is pretty impressive. And if we ever have supercomputers with greater than human capacities, they could learn even more. So we have different kinds of knowledge that we could talk about. We have what might be called personal knowledge. And that's actually a pretty good word for it. And if you follow the work of Michael Polanyi and others, Polanyi actually wrote a book called Personal Knowledge. It's sometimes called tacit knowledge. That's the knowledge of the brain. It's subsymbolic, it's ineffable, it is nothing more or less than neurons connected to each other based on input and producing output, like me talking about, I don't know, barley. But we also have public or social knowledge, which might be, say, the knowledge of an entire community. An example I use a lot is flying from New York to Paris in a 747. Best plane ever built. No individual person has that knowledge. It's too much knowledge. You think about what it entails, right? Building tires, building windshields, aerodynamics, navigation, serving coffee, because it's a 747. Piloting the plane and hopefully landing the plane. You know, there's a whole network of people who do this. They work together. They interoperate. And collectively they have this social knowledge that I might call knowing how to fly a 747 from New York to Paris. So, language, mathematics, logic, etc., the symbolic things, are examples of public knowledge, not personal knowledge. Language is a thing that we create through our interactions with each other. And internally, what we have are nothing more than the patterns of connectivity that we experience as our sensations. So, we can have language and logic and all of that, but it's a separate system entirely from what's actually going on inside our heads. So, how do we learn language and mathematics, etc.? The process, again, is recognition. Our neural network recognizes a word like the word Paris. We don't store the word Paris in our head. That would be stupid. There's no place to put it. It's like, I can go to a hockey game. I don't store the hockey game in my head. How could I? The rink is like 300 feet long. Well, my head's only 6 inches or so. Right? So we don't store words. We don't store public phenomena inside our head. But we form an organization in our head so that we recognize these public phenomena. Home stretch. Last little bit. How do we learn any discipline then? What is it to learn? What is it to learn to be a doctor? What is it to learn to be a chemist or a physicist or a hockey player or whatever? Well, it is not the acquisition of a body of knowledge that we have internalized, even if we can produce an output that satisfies, say, answers on a test, right? Even if we can produce instances of memory, we haven't actually learned it. And indeed, I could refer to John Searle's Chinese room example in this context. You can actually produce output without understanding what you've produced. I think we know that. Go to any kid, say 12 to 14 years. Give them a string of words to memorize, taken from an advanced calculus text. They can memorize those words, but they cannot apply those words to advanced calculus. They have not thereby become a mathematician. Indeed, even if they could, by some act of didactic memory, reproduce the entire text of words, word for word, beginning to end, they have still not learned calculus. So, what's actually going on when we learn to be a physicist, chemist, or whatever, is that we recognize things in a manner characteristic of physicists, chemists, etc. What do I mean by that? Well, just in terms of practical performance, we use the words, language, the same way another chemist does. If I say boron, I mean roughly the same thing as another chemist does when the other chemist uses the word boron. And we use these words correctly and habitually. We don't make odd and weird mistakes. We see the same sorts of things as problems. Like, it's within our discipline to find out what the melting temperature of boron is. We all agree that that's a problem. We also all agree that that's a problem that's been solved. But we're not worried about things like, I don't know, think of something that's not chemistry. We accept the same sorts of things as evidence overall. You know, we might argue about it, but overall, you know, there's a process that defines, you know, what chemists do, how a chemist would prove what the melting point of boron is, how they would present that as evidence, etc. We see the world as a chemist. We live in the world as a chemist. We interact, especially with other chemists, the way chemists typically interact. Thomas Kuhn said, the way of learning a science is learning how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. And what he meant wasn't getting the answers right because we remembered them. Because if you've studied science, you'll know that the answers to the questions at the end of the chapter are never in the chapter. Same with mathematics, same with logic. I hate that. Right? The answers to the questions at the end of the chapter aren't just testing your knowledge, they're testing whether you think like a chemist or you think like a mathematician. So they always go a little bit beyond, or they take something and apply it in a way that wasn't applied before, or they want you to bring together two concepts that were introduced and do it in the way a chemist would. Similarly, you know, even in a chemist textbook or in a math textbook, etc., they will, as I always said, skip steps in the explanations, right? That's why if you just reading a chemistry text and you haven't studied chemistry, if you're just reading the text, it's not going to make sense to you because they're going to skip steps. So their reasoning won't be obvious to you. It'll just be a set of disconnected facts. But if you're a chemist and they say one thing and then they say the next and then they say the next, your thinking is, oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh yeah, that makes sense. That's why I hated math class, because I couldn't read the textbooks. Because I just didn't have that mathiness in the back of my head. Not until I studied probability, and then I went back, got that. And the way I did it is I took a chapter, and the way I discovered this, actually, I took a chapter of a book on probability, analyzed it beginning to end, and I analyzed it formally. For every sentence in that chapter, I actually reproduced it as a logical formula so that I could get the precise inference from step to step to step. And that's when I realized they were skipping steps. I had to invent a variable, introduce the variable, manipulate the variable, and eventually dismiss the variable to get to the next point. Skip step. But of course, the mathematician would just say, oh, yeah, yeah, okay. It's like, you know, they just use I there. Okay. So you see the difference, right? To become a physicist is to acquire the organization, the connectivity in the brain between neurons, characteristic of physicists. So, learning is the development of that organization. Education, I guess, would be the creation of systems, mechanisms, and environments conducive to developing that organization. That would be my best guess at the distinction between these two. Certainly, if for some reason I'm thinking about either myself becoming a chemist or myself as a policy developer trying to produce many chemists in society for whatever reason, what I'd try to do is put either myself or other people into a position where this organization is most likely to develop. It won't be by feeding them a bunch of facts, because that's not going to create that kind of organization. It will have to do with performing authentic chemist tasks, talking a lot with other chemists, solving chemist problems, and learning over time through exposure to chemists and their environment how to see the world and think as a chemist. Because that is the knowledge that a chemist has, as opposed to a set of facts, what people think is the knowledge that a chemist has. And that essentially is the philosophy of connectivism. We put people into these networks. We put people into these networks so that they can interact, become part of this public network that learns all about chemistry. They can be a productive part of that network by recognizing, by internalizing and growing the sort of mind that participates in that network. So it's a network process on the public scale, on the public dimension, because we're interacting, working with, experiencing, etc. And it's a network process on the personal level, because we're developing this characteristic organization of mental, or characteristic organization of connections between neurons. Is there anything else I wanted to say? I could talk about a lot more, but I think I'll stop there and see what you guys have to say.
Jay, go ahead.
You watch Netflix? Like, that's a weird opener, but have you ever, watched a series on there?
Have I ever watched a series on Netflix? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. There's this series on there called The Mind Explained, and I watched it a couple of days ago.
Oh yeah.
And they had this episode on memory, and it featured this woman who does memory competitions. So she'll have to memorize whole pages or whole books, and then she'll be asked point out a specific word on page 72 or something.
Yeah.
But when you were talking about, I think, Hebbian associations,
yep.
It was, when you said what fires together, wires together, it reminded me of that, because in order to remember things, she uses this technique called a memory palace.
Yeah.
So basically, instead of just feeding herself that information and forcing herself to remember it, in order, what she'll do is she'll associate certain words or letters or numbers with memories of hers or somewhere that she knows really well, so that it's as if she's walking through a physical place when she's trying to remember something.
Yeah.
So that's just reminded me of.
Yeah, memory palace is, I've heard of that. I don't use that myself, but it works for a lot of people. Any sort of mnemonic is going to work in a similar manner. It's like the scale, right? Every good boy deserves fudge or whatever. It's just easier. But we need to keep in mind, right? There isn't an actual picture of a palace in the person's head, right? They've associated the elements of the palace with the elements that they're trying to remember, such that if they recall the palace, if they're in some way cued to recognize a palace, that in turn enables them to recognize all the elements that are associated with the palace. I see another hand tentatively coming up in the middle row there. Yeah,
Ira, go ahead.
If truth isn't real and nothing's really objective, why do our societies like try to pin truth to something or try to pin objective?
Yeah. I mean, you're asking for an explanation as to why society does something. Like, why does society do anything? I can think of other things that society does that are more wonder-inducing. But okay, why do we have the concept of truth in the first place? And I didn't get into this at all. So, we think that constructions of language and logic and mathematics represent phenomena in the world. And in fact, the relation between this structure in mathematics or language or math, I'll call it a model or a representation. The relationship between that and the state of affairs in the world is called an interpretation of the model or an interpretation of the representation. And one of the ways of interpreting a representation is through the mechanism of truth. So in other words, truth is a property of a model or representation that explains or describes its relation to the world. So far, so good? Yeah, it's hard. I tore my hair out learning this because there's a whole... There's an entire world of advanced semantics that deals with this crap. Sorry. All right. So, I'm not done yet, but I'm almost done. People thought, and still mostly think, that this entire system of mathematics, language, and logic is also in the brain. And truth is what connects what's in the brain with the external world. And that's why it feels really important to them. So you see what they've done, right? They've taken something that's out there in the world, they think it exists in the brain, and then they create this relation between the thing in the brain and the outside world. So they've taken these two steps. But really what's happening is the model or representation is in the world. The world is in the world. And it's a pretty straightforward mapping. It only becomes hair-pulling if you say all of that's also in your brain. But none of that's in your brain. But people don't know that none of that's in your brain. They really do think that they think in language or that they think in mathematics. You, I'm sure, or at least some of you, probably all of you, have a voice inside your head, right? Who has a voice inside your head? How many of you? Yeah, all of you, right? So, it's natural... That's pretty impressive, all of you. It's natural for you to think that you think in language. All right? But the properties of language that are out there in the world, the logical relations between entities, etc., don't end up in your head. Only the sound of somebody saying the words ends up in your head. Or only... The sight of the words, some of you might think in pictures as well. So that's why first of all, how we get to the idea of truth, and secondly, why we think it's so important. Because if the stuff that's in our head isn't true, it feels like there's this disassociation between what we're thinking, what's there in the world, and that's really messed up, right? But there is, in fact, a disassociation. We're not really thinking in words. We're thinking in our sensory experience of words. See the difference? I know, isn't that messed up? Okay, the woman in the orange shirt. I think it's orange, might be red. Yes.
Yeah, just like, in, I don't know if you know the reading that we did.
Which reading?
Just the recent one. But anyways, this reading about connectivism, mm-hmm. it was talking about how, like, connectivism, like, is, like, knowledge and learning with, like, an emphasis in, like, digital technology and stuff like that. But, like, if you're saying that, like, knowledge is connections and stuff like that, like, how does that translate to, like, a digital platform of, like, learning? Because to me it seems more removed and, like, less connective. Does that make sense?
No. Try again.
Okay. I don't know if this is, if I'm interpreting this correctly, but, like, at least what I understood from this paper was mm-hmm. that connectivism as, like, a learning tool employs, like, digital and, like, online tools. And I'm just, like, wondering how that works if, like, the idea behind connectivism is that it's based off of, like, relationships and connections when that's, like, so much harder to, like, achieve on a digital level.
Yeah, I gotcha. That's a good one. Yeah. Let me answer that question in a slightly snarky way, but I'm hoping you'll get the point. Okay. We do not think. You know, our bodies are not powered by gasoline and internal combustion. Well, they are internal combustion, but they're not powered by gasoline, right? But nonetheless, we use cars to get around. So it's the same sort of thing. We are not digital computers. In fact, we work very differently from the Mac that's sitting on your desk. For one thing, we actually work. The Mac doesn't. No, just kidding. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. I always try to get a jab in at Mac somewhere and all. But we're not a digital computer, quite clearly, right? We don't store information, etc., etc. But still, we can use computers in order to accomplish things in the world. So one thing that we use computers for is to talk to other people, right? And talking to other people like we're doing here, right? Yeah, sure, it's going through a computer on my end, a computer on your end, the internet in the middle, and that entire signal is digital, such that we have to have digital signal processors both on my end and on your end to make it work. So there's a pile of technology happening there. And it's useful to know how that technology works. But the reason we use that technology is so that I can look at you and see you nod when I say something, which you just did and are doing again, right? So we're creating this interaction between the two of us. Now we're each two nodes in a network. I'm sending a signal to you. You're getting that signal. Content of the signal doesn't matter a whole lot. But, you know, how it changes what you do in the future does matter, because you will propagate signals to other people. But the technology that we use is used to make that signal possible. Without the technology, and this is why the technology is important. Without that technology, you and I never have this conversation. You and I never know each other exists. So we now have the capacity to develop globally, socially, a much more complex network than we were able to in the past. In the past, we were stuck with crappy networks. Crappy not just technologically, but crappy by design. Crappy in the sense that the network was really focused on a small number of individuals that we might call kings or chief executive officers who would broadcast and everybody would have to do what they say. Now we have the kind of network where we can interact, and we can interact in a much more fine-grained manner. And the structure of the network matters, right? Not just any old network is going to learn or learn properly. And we could talk about that at some length. But what the technology does for us is allow us to develop a network of sufficient complexity and with the desirable properties so that we as individuals can learn from it and we as a society can learn through it. And so that's where the talk of connectivism, knowing its networks and all of that, overlaps with digital technology. Does that make sense? I once promised myself never to say, does that make sense? Because it's kind of condescending and I don't want to do that. But it's also, I want to be able to know that you understand. Because, well, anyhow. Person in the back with the hand up.
Hello. I have a question. So I would definitely say that it's very safe to argue that technology as a form of, you know, making networks and connections is a really good way to transfer knowledge and such. But I think, like, without the human, like, technology is a very dangerous way of making people sort of, like, more ignorant. Like, for example, like, you go to a doctor, right? And you go, I have a cough, right? Mm-hmm. And they tell you, you have a cold, here's... Well, cold, they don't give you antibiotics for cold. You have a flu, here's some anti... You know what I'm saying? Give you medicine.
I get
so,
you. Yeah.
But then you go on the phone, and you have a cough, and it tells you you have cancer. So it's like, without the human aspect to technology, I just find that it just leads itself to a lot of ignorance and anxiety. So where do you say is, like, the balance? That was my preface.
Yeah.
Where do you say is the balance? And like educational systems and the use of technology to make it more human instead of just like doing technology for technology's sake or like, you know,
okay.
My electronics.
I'm going to be a bit pedantic. I hope it's okay. But I think it's necessary to form a proper answer. Part of the me being pedantic is we don't transfer knowledge. I know it feels like we transfer knowledge, right? Because you're sending a sentence to me or I'm sending a sentence to you, but that's not what knowledge is. That's just content, right? So, and we send content back and forth to each other, but it's, you know, as I said before, it's the overall structure of the neural network in your mind that constitutes the knowledge, and you can't transmit that. The best you can do is send some information that might perhaps cause a change in that structure. Okay. I know that's pretty pedantic and pretty picky, but what about the case where somebody goes to WebMD and they think, oh my God, I got cancer because I have a freckle. So, clearly we have a failure happening here. So the first thing is, simply because you have a network doesn't mean that you always get the results you want. You notice how I'm phrasing? I'm phrasing that carefully. I'm not saying doesn't mean you don't get falsehoods, doesn't mean you don't get false beliefs, etc. I'm being pretty careful there. Because in the larger scheme of things, it doesn't really matter if you're wrong about whether or not you have cancer. Because you either do or you don't. And if you do, you're going to die. And if you don't, you're not going to die. Never mind. It's not that simple, obviously. But the structure of the network matters a lot. Okay? And what you're describing here is, in a sense, a network failure. So, let's suppose, to take a bit of a shortcut here, let's suppose you actually do come out of all of your interactions with the belief that you have cancer and that this belief is not true. So that, and what I mean by that is, if somebody asked you, do you have cancer, you would answer yes, whereas in fact a medical test would result in a doctor answering no. So I'm being very precise here, because there isn't a fact in your, yeah. Okay, so that's an undesirable result. How did that come to be? All right, it isn't simply you consulted the internet. Because you didn't consult the internet, you consulted WebMD or whatever it was in the scenario you described. We'll go with WebMD. WebMD is an example of the structure of the internet as it exists today, where we have a smallish number of very influential websites. An example of what's known as a power law. In a power law in network distribution, there's a small number of very influential members of the network, very well connected, for example, and then a long tail of not so well connected members. And the problem in this case is the very well-connected member is telling you you have cancer, and the not-so-well-connected members are the ones who would be saying you don't have cancer. I don't know if you can see my hand gestures here. They make a lot of sense. Okay, this is the... Yeah. All right, so that is a symptom that the network is not configured properly. We want to reduce the influence of this big spike and increase the influence of the long tail so that we have a more equitable network distribution. And this reduces the probability that one misinformed website can convince you that you have cancer when you don't. And the way you change this is you change the structure of the network so that it is more of a mesh and less of a hub and spoke. The internet as it exists now is way too much like a hub and spoke. Interestingly, it's less of a hub and spoke than the financial system and the political system, where the power law is even more in evidence. But if you want a reliable internet, you want to be able to have the doctors on the internet have as much influence as somebody with some financial backing and a big web server. That's the answer, basically. And to a large degree, a lot of the questions of fake news will need to be addressed in a similar manner, right? You can't just simply outlaw fake news because the people who write the laws are as fake as the news they're trying to outlaw. So you need a network structure that limits the capacity of single individuals to propagate knowledge that's not true. And then you depend on all of the members of the network to be able to self-organize in such a way that the network reliably perceives or represents or interacts with the world as a whole. It's a long-winded answer of just of what could have been a shorter answer. The structure of the the structure of the internet as it exists now is broken. We need to fix it.
So, Stephen, we're at the end of our time.
Yep.
So my sense is that we could, there's lots more discussion to have, but not today.
Yeah, gotcha. So,
yeah, but thank you so much for spending this time with us. I don't know if you guys say goodbye or give a round of applause or something. And we recorded this, but we can post it and then refer back to it the week we can in text as we go through, because I am pretty confident that, Stephen, the conversation you started with us today is something we're going to be continuing over the rest of the semester, and I'll keep you posted about that.
Yeah, no, I have the audio recording as well, which I'll post on my website. If you send me the video, I'll post that on my website, and that way we
Great.
Can share it. So.
Great, thanks so much.
Thank you. This was fun. Thanks for being there.
No, thanks for being with us. All right, so did everybody got my email with the assignment, the show what you know thing? Okay, great. And I didn't get any questions, but if you have